And now we begin the sixth week of the fourth Tower of Inverness. But for Jack, it's as though 3 days had passed. The time moves differently when in the realm of Inverness. Whoever the ancients were that inhabited this mountain, their ceremonies, their worship of the gods, created vibrations so strong they pierce deep into the earth and rock of Inverness. The roots of the trees and grass have drunk of these vibrations, until the very vegetation upon the mountain at times appears to shimmer with sacred praises to the gods. But there are those that tap these vibrations and channel them into other uses. When we last left Jack Flanders, he had once again seen the fourth tower of Inverness. He ran as fast as he could to the mansion, ran through the secret passageways inside the walls, until he came to a dead end with a full-length mirror upon the wall. Investigating, he found the mirror was a door. Behind the door was another mirror. But when he stepped through it, he found himself standing upon a concrete ledge with steps beyond leading into the tower. But in between, nothing but space, clouds below drifting by, and he was in the fourth tower. But he could not leap the space to climb the steps. So there he stands.
Darn! I can't jump that distance. It's about 12 feet to those steps. I get this far, and now I have to turn back. I don't know when the tower will show itself again. Oh, shoot. Why is it that every time I get what I want, it's not what I expected? That's the story of my life. Oh, well. Back out and through the mirror.
So, Jack, little Frida dissolved into color and disappeared. She's a sensitive girl, but I'm certain she'll be able to take care of herself.
Well, you don't seem very concerned, Auntie.
I don't know how concern will help her. I suppose she was caught up with the ecstasy of the moment and just let herself dissolve.
She's not a lump of sugar.
She is sweet. No, Jack, the reason I'm not overly concerned... I am concerned, but just enough. You see, the reason is that little Frida has abilities that human beings... normal human beings haven't realized.
You're inferring that she's done this before.
I'm inferring? No, no. I'm saying quite explicitly that she may have decided at the moment that everything was exactly right, exactly as it should be, and let go.
She didn't die, did she?
Oh, Jack, the way you say that, I'm surprised at you. After re-experiencing several past lives, I would have thought your view of death would be healthier than that. Why, even your Time magazine has altered their column, Births and Deaths, or whatever it was, to Transitions. Soon people will realize that they just keep coming back and coming back. Do you mind being born again?
Not that much. But I could do without going through high school again.
Oh, I see. You've changed the line. That's fair. Jack, do you recall my mentioning to you the Tibetan wheel of life?
Yes, I do.
These Tibetans have it all down pat, as they say. I think you mentioned seeing the wheel in the library, was it not?
Yes, I did.
Now, concentrate on it. Focus a picture of the wheel in your mind. Can you do that?
Just vaguely. It's difficult.
Well, forget the wheel for a moment. Concentrate on any other image. For instance, a white elephant.
Okay, I've got it.
You can see the white elephant?
Yes, clearly.
Ah, well then you can see the wheel. It's very simple. You must learn to train your mind to run errands for you.
Well, that sounds simple, but I'm just not certain that I can do
it. A little practice is all you need, Jack. The mind can be sent out to gather information of all sorts. Why, it's like speaking on a telephone, being able to see the other person, what he or she is wearing, the room around him.
Well...
You don't do that, I presume.
Well, that sounds kind of psychic.
It's words like that, Jack, that cause people to think they cannot, they cannot, they cannot. When you realize that you can, then you can sit in the leisure of your armchair or sip your tea as I am doing now and send your mind out to gather all sorts of things.
If you say so.
It's expressions of enthusiasm like that one that will get you at least another 15 lifetimes.
I don't think being reborn is so bad.
Oh, it's not reborn. It's growing old physically and listening to your bones creak. That's so tiresome. But let me continue with the Tibetan wheel of life. It's most important.
Go on.
Now, as you can see, you can see the wheel.
Oh, yes, clearly, yes.
On the outer rim, there are 12 characters.
Mm-hmm.
A blind woman representing ignorance, feeling her way with a stick, is the first. Can you see it?
Yes, a blind woman.
Now, because of his spiritual blindness, man blunders through life, creating an illusory picture of himself and the world. His will is then directed upon unreal things, while his character is formed in accordance with this direction of his will, and his desire, and his imagination.
Hmm.
Now, the next figure is the potter. Can you see the potter?
Yes, yes.
The form creating activity. Just as the potter creates the shape of pots, so we form our characters and our destiny, or more correctly, our karma. The outcome of our deeds in works, words, and thoughts. These volitional acts become a cause of new activity and constitute the directing principle or character of a new consciousness.
Oh, I don't know if I get that.
Oh, Jack, listen carefully. Character is nothing but a tendency of our will. A formation of repeated actions. Every deed we do leaves a trace, a path formed by the process of walking. And wherever such a once-trodden path exists, there we find, when a similar situation arises, that we take to this path spontaneously. This is the law of action and reaction, what we call karma, the law of movement in the direction of the least resistance, meaning the frequently trodden and therefore easier path. It is what is commonly known as the force of habit.
Hmm.
Does that sound familiar?
Yes.
Now, just as the potter forms vessels out of formless clay, so we create through deeds, words, and thoughts out of the still unformed material of our life and our sense impressions, the vessel of our future consciousness, namely that which gives it form and direction.
I don't know. That sounds pretty heavy.
Buck up, Jack. You'll get it yet. Would you like some tea?
Yes, I think I could do with some.
Good. We'll take a break then. Jives! Jives! Clear away this rubble and bring up a new tea set. Ah! And some more crumpets. Ah, nothing quite like a brisk cup of tea. But to continue. This consciousness, which stands at the beginning of a new life, is represented in the third picture, in the form of a monkey grasping a branch. Do you see that, Jack?
Yes.
Now, just as a monkey restlessly jumps from branch to branch, so the consciousness jumps from object to object.
Ah.
Consciousness, however, cannot exist by itself. It has, on the one hand, both the properties of incessantly grasping sense objects or objects of imagination, and of letting go of one object for the sake of another. But it also has the capacity to crystallize and to polarize itself into material forms and mental functions.
Hmm?
Consciousness is the basis of the combination, you've heard it referred to, mind and body. This close relationship between bodily and mental functions is compared with two people in a boat. This is shown in the fourth picture, in which you can see a ferryman propelling a boat with two people in it. Do you see it, Jack?
Ah, yes.
Ah, good show. Now, next we have a house with six windows, which depicts the six senses: seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and thinking. And the sixth picture symbolizes the contact of the senses with their objects, in the form of the first contact between lovers. Do you see that, Jack?
Yes, very nice.
The feeling resulting from the contact of the senses with their objects is represented in the seventh picture by a man whose eye has been pierced by an arrow.
Mm. That's a bit strong, don't you think?
Bear with me, Jack. The eighth picture shows a drinker who is served by a woman. It symbolizes the thirst for life, or craving caused by agreeable sensations. The arrow in the eye does not indicate pleasure, but only the intensity of the feeling, and perhaps its future painful consequences, which overtake those who allow themselves to be carried away by agreeable sensations.
I don't know. I never thought of Tibetans as prudes, but they seem to take a lot of the old kick out of life.
From the thirst for life arises the grasping of and clinging to the desired objects. This is symbolized in the ninth picture by a man who plucks fruit from a tree and gathers it into a basket. Clinging leads to the strengthening of the bonds, the bounds of life, and to a new process of becoming. This is symbolized by the sexual union of a man and wife, as seen in the tenth picture.
That's pretty explicit, all right.
The Tibetan attitude toward sexual things is of a disarming naturalness and objectivity. The Tibetan does not hesitate to depict the sexual act and the act of giving undisguised and without ambiguity. Now, the 11th picture shows a woman giving birth to a child. Becoming leads to rebirth in a new existence.
They're just as active as beavers, aren't they?
Jack, be serious. The 12th picture shows a man who carries a corpse on his back to the cremation ground, which illustrates the last of the 12 links of the formula of dependent origination, which says that all that which has been born leads to old age and death. As I have told you on another occasion, if there had not been a will to live and a clinging to the corresponding forms of life, this process of becoming would not have been set into motion.
It's just a vicious circle, isn't it?
That is why the 12-fold formula of dependent origination is represented as a circle. It has neither a beginning nor an end. Do you see? Each link represents the sum total of all other links and is the precondition as well as the outcome of all other links. And all phases of this dependent origination are phenomena of the same illusion, the illusion of egohood. By overcoming this illusion, we step beyond the circle in which we imprison ourselves, and we realize that no thing and no being can exist in itself or for itself, that each form of life has the whole universe as its basis, and that the meaning of individual form can only be found in its relationship to the whole. The moment in which the human individual becomes conscious of this universality, he ceases to identify himself with the limits of his temporal embodiment and becomes flooded with a fullness of life in which the distinction between past, present, and future does not exist anymore.
Amen.
And all this has been simply explained by Lama Govinda in his Foundations of Tibetan Mysticism, a book I do recommend.
Well, I'll be sure to read it.
Good, Jack. Hacha! Let's have another cup of tea. Here, I have a copy for you right now, and it's signed by the Lama Govinda. My goodness, interesting handwriting he has. Shows he's a mystic.